Good afternoon. Going to open the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources.
And I'm going to open the House Committee on Environment and Water.
Thank you. And we are still waiting for a few Senate members. It's not a really good way to start a joint hearing because we want to make a good impression on the other body here, the other part of the body, I should say. But my members do show up on time every now and then, so hopefully. And look, on cue. There we go. So with that, I wanted to welcome the House Committee on, it's Water and Environment now. You guys changed the name.
Environment and Water.
Environment and Water. Okay. I want to welcome the committee members. Senate members probably realize that this is a joint hearing and we moved hearing rooms. I know that's probably why you were late. But we're really honored to
have... Yeah, we've been sitting in C for the last 10 minutes.
Saying, where is everybody? Really honored to be able to do this very interesting informational hearing jointly. So with that, do I need to open up actual information hearing?
No, okay.
So you probably saw from the agenda, this is actually an informational meeting. It's not a public hearing. There will be public hearings on some of the bills you're going to hear about later on in both on both the House and Senate side. But I just wanted to say a few introductory comments before I hand it over to my colleague and former vice chair, Representative Ben Cannon. This is a really exciting, I think, agenda we have here today. Many of you know that last session we worked on a wide range of bills regarding renewable energy and climate change. And so one of them in particular, the Integrated Climate Change Act, was passed overwhelmingly and bipartisan in both House and Senate in response to concerns about climate change and its impacts on our economy, public health, and environment. The Oregon legislature adopted specific goals, that's last session, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and we did not, however, adopt specific measures on how to meet those goals. So what you're going to hear today, colleagues, is some background information. There's been a lot of work done during the interim from different groups, but in particular, one of the groups that we assigned to do this, which is the Climate Change Commission, or I guess the Global Warming Commission is the official name, but looking at issues around climate change. So you're going to hear from an array of experts today about how we can lessen those impacts from climate change, what's the best approach, and also what other states are doing. I wanted to say that we have a new member from the Oregon State University, Phil Moat, is going to be with us from the Climate Change Research Institute. Very exciting time. We worked on setting this up last session, so it's great that Mr. Moat can join us. Angus Duncan is the chair of the Global Warming Commission. They have had, I want to say hundreds, because I know it isn't, but it seems like hundreds of meetings since last session with multiple subcommittees. So we're going to hear from Angus today on the recommendations that come out of the Global Warming Commission and their subcommittees. We're going to have an overview of the actions from the United Kingdom on climate change. So we actually are going to have an international perspective here today, and I appreciate, did you come all the way from London for this?
I come from San Francisco this morning.
Okay. And I know we did not pay to fly you up here, so we appreciate that since we don't have the funds to do that. So we really do appreciate the fact that you're able to come up here. We also are going to hear from other states, our states in the north and south, and what they're doing. We get asked this all the time. What are our neighbors doing in comparison of what Oregon's doing? So we're going to hear both from the folks who are on the ground working on this issue in Washington via phone, and then we have the senior policy advisor for the California Air Resources Board who was able to be here in person, and we really appreciate that, and again, on his own dime. We are also going to hear from Bob Doppelt, who's the director of Resource Innovations, the Institute for Sustainable Development at that other university, the University of Oregon. We're a full opportunity committee here. And then we're finally going to hear from the governor's office about how this the suite of bills that the governor is proposing this session. So we have a really exciting agenda. Certainly we're going to take time for questions, but one of the things that we're going to do is try to make sure we get through all the presentations during the short time that we have. And with that, I'm going to ask my former vice chair, and now the chair of the House committee, to provide us a little bit of context for this discussion before we head off into hearing the presentations.
Well, thank you,
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Senate Chair. And I don't, committee members don't have much to add to that introduction. As I do want to assure members of my committee, this will not be the last time, it is the first time we're talking about climate change. It will not be the last time. And in the context of additional bills, we'll have we will have opportunities for public testimony, for hearing of a broad range of the kinds of issues that we may not have substantive discussion of today. But what when Senator Dingfelder and I got together to begin to plan this hearing, I think we were interested in questions such as, what does the best available current science tell us about the impact of climate change on the Northwest's environment? What do we know about the impacts of climate change on the Oregon economy? What are we learning about that? What are we doing as a state to address climate change, and what additional options may we have this session? And finally, what are our counterparts in Western states and across the globe, from Britain, doing to address climate change? And what you'll see reflected in this agenda is really a state, an official sort of state, the state of Oregon, folks from our agencies and their perspectives. As I said, we'll have the opportunity to hear from stakeholders with their range of perspectives on these issues in the context of specific bills, but thought it was important to begin with a sense of where our state government, where, you know, the folks whose budgets, agency budgets we pass, are on this issue, what they're telling us and telling Oregonians. So with that, I think we're ready to begin with Phil Mote. So Phil, please join us. And Phil's with the Climate Change Research Institute at Oregon State University.
Thank you to both chairs and the committees for having me here. I am still at the University of Washington. Haven't begun working yet at Oregon State University. And in fact, the Institute, the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute, which I will join in mid-March, is part of the Oregon University system. So even though it's based at OSU, and there will be a lot of orange around my the exterior of my office, I plan to have flags of many Oregon public universities in my office.
And Phil, could you just state your name for the record? I'm going to remind witnesses when they come up that there's lots of folks listening through webcast, so if you can just remember when you start your presentation to make sure and repeat your name.
Thank you. My name is Philip Mote. Well, before I begin with a sort of update on global climate science, which is what I was asked to do, I want to just say a few more words about the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute. I'm very excited to have been asked to lead this new institute, and looking at the network of people who have already attached themselves to the institute, part of what attracted me to Oregon was the enthusiasm that this group of researchers at several of Oregon's public universities had for doing applied climate research. There's a unique opportunity to really build this institute into something that's the envy of other states, because it is a product of the Oregon University system. It draws on the intellectual resources of all of the public universities, not just one. And by drawing on this broader range of researchers, part of what we want to do, I want to focus on those last two words in the name, the Research Institute. We want to successfully compete for federal research dollars. We just learned this morning that stimulus bills considered by the House and the Senate back in Washington, D.C. are knocking around numbers like $500 million to $1 billion for new climate research. What better way for us to compete for that than to have a strong institute here in Oregon? The other part of the name I want to focus on is Oregon. This is an institute that is focused on providing climate expertise to climate questions that Oregonians have, to support the work of the Global Warming Commission by providing good science advice and education. We, over the coming months, as I take the directorship, we'll be building a core staff, weaving this network of researchers into teams of people who can tackle some of the questions that Angus Duncan posed in his very, very long list of research questions when I first started discussing this with him as part of the interview process last fall. So we look forward to providing science advice to Oregon through that institute. Before I talk about the science of climate change, I want to talk about the science of the science. I and other researchers publish papers that have to go through a process of scrutiny called peer review, which ensures that we can back up our arguments with good data and good analysis. There are so many thousands of papers on the subject of climate change, and it's so important, there's no way for one person or even a group of people to understand all of those papers. So in 1988, the United Nations and the World Meteorological Organization created the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, whose charge is to produce assessment reports every 5 or 6 years that summarize the state of climate science. This is a very, very elaborate process, which I'll come to in a minute, but I just want to stress that when we come up with statements about climate change that may oppose something you've read on a website, there's a very different process that the IPCC has for coming up with statements. It's also said sometimes that the IPCC consists of a bunch of bureaucrats that write these reports. Nothing could be further than the truth. This diagram shows the structure of the IPCC. The IPCC plenary consists of appointed representatives of the member nations, about 180 in all. They provide 30,000 foot level guidance and oversight of the IPCC process, and they have a staff working for them known as the IPCC Bureau. They only meet once or twice a year typically in plenary. The actual science reports are written by working groups. Working group one of the last assessment report and the next one, which is just beginning, covers the scientific basis. The second working group covers impacts, vulnerability, and adaptation. The third group, mitigation. And you can see that a lot of the subjects of these are things that the Oregon Global Warming Commission and state agencies are very interested in understanding. Now, all of these working groups are staffed by scientists, and I worked in working group one last time, and this is a sort of a pan shot of a group photo. There's me between two New Zealanders on the left of the picture. Very international group, 150 lead authors just for working group one. I stress that because this is not a small panel. The process of producing this fourth assessment report, which I was involved in, included four international meetings and three rounds of peer review. So we met, we came up with a very detailed outline, writing assignments. We produced in a couple of months the first draft, which was called the zero order draft, sent it out for peer review. We had to deal with those peer review comments. We produced the next draft. That was sent out for public review. We received 16,000 comments, and we had to detail how we dealt with every one. I stress this again because there is no more open and thorough process for conveying science than the IPCC. Two rounds of peer review, not enough, so we had a third round of peer review. This was all built in, and the timeline was very rigid. We produced our final draft in October of 2006. The summary for policymakers was produced sort of in parallel, and that was argued line by line. This was the only interference by policymakers, and essentially the nature of the debate in Paris in February of 2007 was over nuances like, should you really use the word very there? And the scientists essentially were called to justify the exact language that they used. I did a before and after comparison of this summary for policymakers, and mostly what I saw was clarification. Policymakers found this sentence vague. They found that claim so interesting that it needed a figure or a table. Things were added to clarify. But there was nothing in there where the policymakers themselves affected the science conclusions. They only affected the way it was stated. The reason I say this is because when I turn to some of the conclusions of the IPCC report, these are not only very firmly grounded in peer-reviewed science, but they themselves have been peer-reviewed three times and put through this very exhaustive process. No website or report from a nonprofit of whatever political stripe can come near the IPCC for its thoroughness. So let's take a look at a couple of things that were in the summary for policymakers. This is a graph of carbon dioxide. The red curve shows direct measurements from Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii, started in 1956. And those other marks show the concentrations from bubbles of gas trapped in ice cores in Antarctica. We're looking at a 10,000-year time slice. That's the entire period of human civilization. And you can see up until the Industrial Revolution in about 1850, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was very stable at between 260 and 280 parts per million in the atmosphere, so less than 0.03%. It nonetheless plays a very important role, as you know, because it's the leading long-lived greenhouse gas. So the beginning of the Industrial Revolution marked a dramatic shift in the carbon cycle of the planet. Humans figured out a way to get energy that had been stored in hydrocarbons buried in the Earth's crust. And an accidental byproduct of that was that carbon dioxide was liberated and began accumulating in the atmosphere. We now have about 38% more than we did during the entire span of human civilization. Carbon dioxide is a very important constituent in the atmosphere, and on the right-hand scale, you can see this notation, radiative forcing. So the amount of carbon dioxide added to the atmosphere is equivalent to 1.5 watts per square meter. You can think of a very small Christmas tree light of 1 watt distributed over the entire planet's surface at intervals of about 3 feet. So imagine adding that much heat to the Earth's surface. That's what we've done by adding this amount of carbon dioxide. And I think the crucial figure for understanding why we talk about a human influence on climate as opposed to just natural variations is this one. The black curve shows average global temperatures in 10-year chunks. And you can see that there was a bit of warming early in the 20th century, and then a period of sort of level temperatures, some might even say a cooling, although if you look at the scientific literature at the time, papers were running at least 3-to-1 that rising greenhouse gases were going to produce a warming. And then we did, in fact, see a warming starting in the 60s or 70s. Now, that's all well and good. There's certainly been lots of climate cycles before, but what's different this time is that we understand the forcings pretty well, and we know what role humans have played. If you look at the blue-shaded area, that is sort of a reenactment of the 20th century climate as if humans were not producing greenhouse gases. So this is a set of simulations with global climate models in which they know about solar variability and volcanic eruptions that really happened, but they don't take into account greenhouse gases. So you can see there was a little bit of warming early in the 20th century, and then a cooling. And the reason for that is a series of large tropical volcanic eruptions late in the 20th century. You can see that that really does not agree at all with what happened since about the 1970s, this very rapid warming. Now, if in addition you tell the models, oh, by the way, greenhouse gases increased, carbon dioxide by 38%, methane by 150%, nitrous oxide, and so on, and then rerun them, you get the red shaded area. And you can see with one exception, the 1940s, the decadal temperatures lay within that envelope. So in other words, we've seen a human influence on climate emerge in roughly the last 30 to 50 years. So that is what led the IPCC to conclude that it's very likely, meaning more than 90% chance, that most of the warming since the mid-20th century is a result of rising greenhouse gases. All of the other explanations that have been put forward have been taken into account. Natural variability like El Nino events, solar variability, cosmic rays, whatever you can think of, it's been studied. And I'll hit a few of these points. But first, I want to provide a little update on the climate science since the IPCC report of 2 years ago. And I want to do so by first focusing on that same figure, but for the land and the ocean. If you look closely at the land figure, you'll see the 1940s bump doesn't stick up above the red area. So in other words, the global land temperatures are consistent with what we understood the greenhouse and natural forcings to be. But on the right-hand side, you'll see that the ocean in the 1940s temperatures poke way up above that red shaded area, which suggests that the planet was doing something different from what we understand. Now, a paper by a former UW grad student, Dave Thompson, which appeared last year, focused on the global temperature record, and in particular on the various bumps and wiggles. So the top is the same kind of figure that I showed earlier, except where that was 10-year average temperatures. These are now monthly average temperatures, so you see a lot more wiggles. The second line shows Thompson's estimate of the contribution to global temperatures by the El Niño Southern Oscillation, or ENSO. And you see I've circled the big bump in 1998 where global temperatures were exceptionally high, and there was a big contribution from the century's largest El Niño, which was followed by a pretty strong La Niña. So you saw this large swing from warming to cooling just because of this natural process. The next panel down represents a pattern where the oceans are warm when the land is cold and vice versa, the so-called cold ocean warm land pattern. And so Dave subtracted those two and got this global residual. Now first, just look at that El Niño event. These are the average temperatures of the ocean surface at the height of that El Niño event in December 1997. You can see some very red colors along the equator over near South America on the right-hand part of that figure, up to 5 degrees Celsius, 9 degrees Fahrenheit, above average. That was a very large anomaly for the tropics, and it pumped heat into the global atmosphere as well, which contributed to that global warmth for 1998. Back to that figure that I showed, let's look at some of these other bumps and wiggles on the bottom graph. I've circled here 5 dips in the global temperature which coincide with these major tropical volcanic eruptions. You can't quite see Krakatoa in 1883 very well, but Santa Maria in 1901, I think it was, Agung in 1961, El Chichon in 82, and Pinatubo in 91. In each case, you see this dip in global temperatures of a couple tenths of a degree Celsius, and then a recovery. But what's striking, and what Thompson pointed out, is there's this huge drop of 0.3 degrees Celsius, half a degree Fahrenheit, in the global temperature record in 1945. And I had always sort of wondered about that, but Thompson really answered the question. They found that, and this is a quote from their paper, the sudden drop in sea surface temperatures in late 1945 is consistent with a rapid but uncorrected change from engine room intake measurements. U.S. ships dominated global shipping during World War II, and they had more sophisticated technology for measuring sea surface temperatures. Switch back to the revival of the U.K. shipping industry late in 1945, which then accounted for 50% of global shipping, but they were measuring temperatures with uninsulated buckets, which lead to cooler readings. So just from that shift, we saw a drop in apparent global temperatures, which has just been identified and has yet to be corrected. Now, none of this says that the Earth wasn't warming. All it does is give us a little better perspective on why there was that apparent inconsistency in the previous diagram that I showed you. So we now see that there was indeed a global warming during the 20th century, and it amounts to about 0.7 degrees Celsius or 1.1 degrees Fahrenheit. Now I want to turn my attention to something that's been very much on people's minds lately, which is, has global warming stopped? And if you look at the right-hand part of that bottom diagram, or indeed the top diagram, you see what looks like a leveling off of global temperatures. Roger Pilkey Jr. in his blog on this subject said it depends on what you mean by stop. The definition of stop is to come to an end. And he and other climate scientists don't believe that global warming has come to an end. Perhaps the better word would be pause, that it has paused. So the question is, can we deduce from this pause that global temperatures will start to go down, or will they start to go up, or will they remain level? Well, we understand very well that greenhouse gases are continuing to accumulate, so we might ask the question, is it possible to get a pause like this in a climate model simulation where gases continue to accumulate? And indeed it is. This is a very scrambled diagram, some might call it a spaghetti diagram, of global temperatures from a couple of dozen different climate model simulations from 1950 to 2020. And I've circled one particular climate model in which you see roughly a 10-year, 8 or 10-year period where global temperatures are stable. And yet the overall response is for continued warming. So we, and I speak broadly for the scientific community, we do not see a pause in global temperature increases as anything other than the sort of behavior that you would get in a time series like this if you look at a short enough period. Let me just ask a question. How many members of the two committees own any stocks, either directly or through a retirement plan, mutual fund, anything
Don't
like that?
Don't remind us, would you?
Anybody own stocks? Nobody claims? Okay, a few are willing to admit. Yes, you own stocks. That is essentially a bet in the long-term future of the economy. If you truly believed that the economy was going to go down and down and down without ceasing, you would probably have sold your stocks by now. It's the same thing with global temperatures. If you look at a very short period, you may see a dip or a flat period. But if you hold those stocks long enough, 10 years, maybe only 5, maybe only 2, who knows, they will go up again. There are irresistible forces, the strength of the American economy, and likewise, rising greenhouse gases will eventually produce an increase. So just a summary about global temperatures. Global warming continues. Greenhouse gases continue to rise. Several years of level temperatures can be seen as consistent with continued warming. It's not a basis to predict cooling. And we have some new science that sheds light on this drop in sea surface temperatures in the 1940s. I just want to touch on a couple of other issues of global science before I turn to the Oregon picture. First of all, solar variability does not explain the recent warming, recent meaning last 30 years. It does provide a little bit of an explanation for the cooling over the last 8 years or the level temperatures that you just saw. This is direct measurements of solar output from a series of satellites flying above the Earth's atmosphere. And you can see the solar cycles. It's actually a very small part of the total solar irradiance. Very, very small differences between solar max and solar min. No overall trend. A slight reduction in solar output consistent with the solar cycle, which peaked in about 2001. Going back to 2007, just after the IPCC report, this paper was published comparing summer Arctic sea ice extent in the observations shown in red with a whole bunch of different climate models. And you see another of these spaghetti diagrams. In these simulations, you see the average of all the models is the heavy black curve, and then you see the individual traces are the colored curves. And they pointed out that all of the models had a sort of steady Arctic sea ice concentration in the first part of the 20th century. We don't have very good observations for then, so we can't say much about that. But from 1950 onward, the models predicted a slow reduction in summer sea ice, but you could see a few examples of individual models in the 1940s where there were very rapid drops. And they noted in this paper that the observed decline seemed to be a little faster than the average of the model declines. Well, then we had the summer sea ice of 2007, which was not only a record minimum, it was also a record year-to-year drop in summer Arctic sea ice extent. Well, in the spring of 2008, Arctic sea ice had recovered quite a bit, and it was more extensive than in recent years. We had several sea ice experts at UW who had an argument about what would the summer minimum for 2008 look like. And the consensus hovered right around the 2007 number. And indeed, 2008 came in just slightly above 2007, but still quite low. This is an animation of sea ice measurements from satellite for the summer of 2008 starting in July. You can see the open patch over on the Alaska side, and particularly the dark colors indicating very thin ice, and that was the problem. The 2007 season left so much open water that it refroze, but it was only single-year ice. Very easy to break it up and melt the next summer. So what most sea ice scientists think is that we've sort of crossed a threshold, and most summers will have continuing very low sea ice for that reason. Let's bring it now to the Northwest. One of the important questions that I get asked a lot is about the flooding. This was a picture of Centralia in 2007, but it looked this way again a few weeks ago. I-5 was inundated by heavy flows on the Chehalis River, so people have asked, have heavy precipitation events increased? Has the incidence of severe floods increased? And if so, is it due to global climate change, or is it something that's just going to reverse and go the other way? This is a study that Kim Kunkel at the Western Regional Climate Center gave me, looking at extreme precipitation changes over the 20th century. Now, I would note that their study ended in 2000, so this does not include the recent events. But what you see is a bunch of blue circles in the Mississippi Basin and parts of the East Coast, but also here in the Northwest. And those blue circles indicate a significant positive increase in heavy precipitation events. And when he broke it down by season, you can see that November-December events have gotten much, extreme precipitation has gotten much heavier here in the Northwest. So it appears that we've already seen this shift toward more heavy precipitation, but we can't yet say whether this is related to greenhouse gases, only that it has occurred. But this is a very hot topic of climate research. And speaking of hot topics, forest fires. Some colleagues at the Climate Impacts Group, the University of Washington, and I did this study of forest fires for all the 11 western states, and we simply mapped each summer's area burned onto that summer's climate. So what you see in this diagram is a bunch of circles. The size of the circle indicates the area burned in that state in a given summer, and the position of that circle indicates the climate of that particular summer. So the higher it is, the more rain fell, and the lower it is, the less rain fell as a percentage of the long-term average for summer. And the farther right it was, the hotter, and the farther left, the cooler. And you can see that most of the big circles are down in that lower right corner of the diagram, meaning we get bigger fires during hot, dry summers. Well, I was working on this paper, and my wife asked me one day, so what are you researching these days? And I said, well, we've discovered that when it's hot and dry, you get bigger forest fires. And she looked at me and said, you have a PhD, and you come up with things like this? It is indeed obvious, but if you look at federal land policy, forest management practices, there was an implicit assumption that climate really made no difference and that the upsurge in forest fires recently is related solely to buildup of fuels. The fuels contribute to the intensity of the fire, but the extent of the fire seems to be largely climate controlled. And you see I've labeled that largest circle there, 2002, that was the Biscuit Fire and several other large fires in Oregon, down as one of the hottest, driest summers. The red arrow on there, incidentally, is the most benign future scenario of climate that we could find among all the climate models, and it still has a more than doubling of area burned in Oregon. So speaking of climate models, this is a summary of the changes projected for the Pacific Northwest for the 2040s relative to 1980s by a whole bunch of different climate models. And I won't go into all the details. Let's just look at the right-hand pair of bars there. Those are two different assumptions about how future greenhouse gases could change. A sort of moderate to low scenario, B1, those are the individual models indicated by circles, and the A1B, which is a slightly more like business as usual in the X's, a somewhat higher scenario. So we could see anything from the most benign climate scenario of 1.5 degree increase in annual temperature over that 60-year period, or about 0.3 degrees Fahrenheit per decade, all the way up to 5 degrees if we follow the slightly higher emission scenario and climate is very sensitive. We've also broken it down by season, and you see that the summer is the season that's projected to warm the most, with one model giving a warming of as much as 8 degrees Fahrenheit over that 60-year period. We've done the same thing for precipitation, and models are equivocal. They can't make up their minds about whether it'll get wetter or drier. Some say much wetter in winter. Many, if not most, most in fact, say that it will get drier in summer. But the annual mean is sort of a wash, as much as 10% up or down for the annual mean. But these drier summers come in the same models that get hotter. So think back to the forest fire figure. Looking at the future, one of the biggest concerns, impacts-wise, is about water resources. This is a diagram put together by researchers in California looking at the fraction of annual precipitation that falls as what we might call warm snow, that is within 10 degrees Fahrenheit, or 10 or 11 degrees Fahrenheit of freezing. And you can see that the Cascades of Washington, Oregon, and the Northern Sierras light up in this bright red color, meaning that two-thirds of the annual precipitation falls as snow, but it's vulnerable to a little bit of warming shifting over as rain. So when we feed that into hydrology models, and this is just an example for the Snake River at Ice Harbor just before it flows into the Columbia, we've done the same kind of thing for many Oregon rivers, and we'll be able to share those in a couple of weeks. We feed these warming scenarios into a hydrology model, and we see these shifts in the state of the hydrograph. The black curve is the average flow month by month for a 20th century climate, and then if we warm it a little bit to the 2030s, we get the blue curve, and then warm it to the 2050s, we get the red curve. So there's an increase in winter flow and a decrease in summer flow, and it's exactly what the previous diagram implied. As it warms up in the Northwest, instead of accumulating snow, you get more immediate runoff as rain. That is then unavailable to runoff in the summer when farmers need it for irrigated agriculture, when hydropower production is going full tilt, and so on. So there are a number of changes. These are, in fact, all observed already. Changes in timing and the amount of flow in Northwest rivers. Portland has looked at this for its water supply. I won't go into details, but considering both the impacts of climate change on supply and demand, it looks like the net impacts are about a half of the impacts of population change alone over this time period. Finally, sea level rise. I'd chalk it up to another crazy backyard hobby, except he's the world's leading authority on global warming. We're not advising anybody to build an ark yet, but we do try to provide sound guidance on the amount of sea level rise to expect, and we were asked so many times to provide such guidance that we finally wrote a report a year ago on sea level rise in Washington. Some of this is applicable to Oregon, but there are just so many things we don't know. We don't know how fast Greenland is going to shed ice into the ocean. We don't know how fast the ocean will warm, how much greenhouse gases will rise, and so on. So this diagram is really meant to convey the uncertainty. We could see very low amounts of sea level rise if all of the ducks line up in our favor. Or we could see amounts of sea level rise of 4 feet or more during the 21st century, which would be quite challenging to deal with. So I want to conclude my remarks with these three thoughts. Global warming continues. It has apparently taken a pause, but there is a bet among climate scientists that was offered to some who predicted cooling, a 2,500 euro bet that the average temperature for the, I think it was 2005 to 15 period, would be warmer. And the scientist who had published a paper advocating that it was going to cool declined to take the bet. So it seems that climate scientists are still pretty convinced that the rising greenhouse gases will continue to propel global temperatures upwards. Regional impacts, much of what we are concerned about here in the Northwest are the way climate change will affect snowmelt-driven hydrology, what that will do to agriculture, municipal and industrial water supply, energy production, forest fires, and then a separate issue is sea level rise. So these are all topics of on which much has been written and much could be said, but I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Are there questions from members of the House Committee?
I got a quick question.
You're Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here. I have a quick question about the slide you had on the snake, but before I ask it, I did want to clarify one point. Perhaps your wife would be interested in this. You were saying then that what goes down must come up. Is that correct?
It depends on the forces. Not everything that goes down must come up, but when there is sort of persistent and growing force in one direction, it becomes harder and harder to reverse that. And a good example is the Mount Pinatubo eruption in 1991. We saw global temperatures dip a few tenths of a degree for a few years. But the volcanic eruptions are eventually cleansed from the atmosphere, and the greenhouse gases are not. They simply accumulate. And so with the rise, continued accumulation of greenhouse gases, and of course the big question is, will we let them accumulate extremely fast, or will we eventually stop them from accumulating? That exerts a continuous influence on the global energy budget.
One other quick follow-up. You don't have to provide this now, but are there figures similar to the ones you shared on the snake for the Columbia itself?
Yes, and part of what we're finishing at the University of Washington is a study that will allow people to get that kind of figure for 150 places in the Northwest, including several on the Willamette, and I think we even have a couple on the Deschutes.
Good. Thank you. Thank you.
Other questions, Representative Smith?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So when I was in high school, the debate was largely around the existence of global warming, and then it moved towards the cause. What is the state of dissent of your, and I'm sure you would probably describe it as the consensus view, but what's the state of dissent of, roughly speaking, these slides and your conclusions, and what can you share with us about that dissent?
Yeah. I think the IPCC is very careful to reflect controversy where it persists, and to say, you know, here's one view, here's another view, this matter does not appear to be resolved. A good example is what's happened with Atlantic landfalling hurricanes. You know, 2005 really imprinted the threat of landfalling hurricanes in people's minds, but the Galveston hurricane in 1900 was far more damaging. And there was another hurricane in about 1912, I think, that hit a relatively unpopulated Miami, which if it hit today, would have made Katrina look fairly tame. But so there's this real question of how much has hurricane activity changed, and what role do greenhouse gases play in those changes? That's a very, very hot topic. I would say there's some debate about the observational support for the extent of changes in hydrology that are represented in this figure. One set of estimates says that the shift in timing in the Northwest has been in the range of 5 to 10 days. One says it's more like in the range of 10 to 15 days. But these are the sorts of arguments that scientists love to have. And I think there's pretty good agreement in the broad brush changes here, reductions in summer flow in any snowmelt-driven river, which in some cases actually means a reduction in flood risk. You know, the Snake River floods and the Columbia, mainstem Columbia, historically, before we had the dams, flooded in June. And, you know, the less snow you have to produce big floods, the less the flood risk.
Any questions from the Senate side?
Sorry, just a quick follow-up.
Yeah, just one follow-up. Running short on time.
So is it true? I can set aside my follow-up. We can talk in the hall. I'm good.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the Senate side? Okay, Senator Nelson.
Thank you. I hope you can clarify some things with me, because I guess I am a skeptic of global warming. I'm not a skeptic of global warming. I'm just a skeptic of the cause, but I have a piece of paper that says a chemical composition, there's atmospheres, 7 to 8% is nitrogen.
Nitrogen, 21%.
About 21% is oxygen. Mm-hmm. Next one is argon, mm-hmm. about not quite 1%.
And water vapor.
And so then we come to carbon dioxide. But water vapor is considered a greenhouse gas.
Water vapor is a greenhouse gas, and the way climate scientists treat it is it's internal to the climate system. And so whatever water vapor does is largely controlled by surface temperature. So when you get a warming, particularly of the tropical oceans, and we see this in El Nino events, it pumps more water vapor into the atmosphere. And then that provides more heating. So it's a feedback mechanism. It's one of many feedbacks. Another one is that when you melt ice, you get a dark surface, and so you absorb more heat. So that's called the albedo feedback. So water vapor is included in these climate models. Without the water vapor response, you don't get the right response to volcanic eruptions. So it's certainly an important greenhouse gas, but it also responds to carbon dioxide. So when you add carbon dioxide, you get more warming than you would get without water vapor.
Philip?
Yes, Pam. We're talking, we went from about 300 parts per million to maybe 400 parts per million.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thing that's always bothered me, that's not a very big shift, and carbon dioxide is actually a good gas, isn't it?
It's essential to life. However, in the atmosphere, it does change the global energy balance. We've measured that change by satellites and by surface measurements. We actually see more infrared radiation reaching the surface of the Earth because there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Simply because something hasn't changed by a large amount doesn't mean that it's not significant. We have very small amounts of potassium in our bodies, but if we had too little, our nervous systems wouldn't function properly. So carbon dioxide is natural. It played a big role in the glacial, interglacial swings in climate. It's very low during glacial times and at roughly pre-industrial levels during interglacial periods. So the greenhouse effect, taken as a whole, carbon dioxide, water vapor, methane, nitrous oxide, so on and so on, provides... in fact, if we had no greenhouse gases at all, the surface temperature of the planet would be around 0 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
So if you only had water vapor, you would not get to the warm climate that we have. And so you add carbon dioxide, you get a warmer climate. You add more carbon dioxide, you get a warmer climate. We've known this from laboratory measurements as well as satellite and surface.
Just to follow up, too, I mean, you're doing this over the last 100 years. Have you done any studies or comparison to the period from the 10th to the 15th centuries when there was another warming trend?
Yeah, and there's a whole chapter in the last IPCC report about paleoclimate, which is understanding climates before 100 years ago. And climate models, when fed the correct information about sunspots and so on, get roughly the right response, whether you're looking 10,000 years ago coming out of an ice age, 1,000 years ago during the Maunder Minimum, 400 years ago. What they don't get right is the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum about 55 million years ago when we had alligators up in Ellesmere Island in northern Canada. They don't make it anywhere near as warm as it actually was. So that's a big puzzle and a concern.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any other questions from the Senate side? Right.
Madam Senator Chair, thank you for your indulgence over here. I know Representative Smith has a quick follow-up he does want to ask.
Very quickly, what percentage of scientists that you would listen to would disagree with the following statement? Global warming is happening, it is at least partly humans' fault, and it's bad. What percentage of scientists would disagree with that comment?
I think you'd get a lot more argument about the last, mm-hmm. because what scientists would say, well, there's some bad and some good. Mm-hmm. But I would, you know, the IPCC, I think, fairly reflects the state of knowledge. In answer to the first question, they used the word unequivocal.
Mm-hmm.
The existence of global warming is unequivocal.
Mm-hmm.
As to human cause, they said greater than 90% chance that most of the warming mm-hmm. is because of human activities, taking into account all of these natural factors. On the third point, that's a value judgment. Who's to say that losing an island nation is bad?
Probably the island nation.
Scientists are loath to make value judgments, but I think you've seen an increasing number saying, look, we write these reports, we make these public statements that this is the science, and we stop short of making any policy recommendation. People who disbelieve that it's a problem are quite free in making policy recommendations, do nothing, and that's a policy recommendation. And so you're increasingly seeing scientific societies saying, remaining uncertainty does not justify continued inaction. and some prudent steps should be taken to tackle this problem.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. And we're going to have to move on because we have six more speakers in the hour and 5 minutes left. But thank you very much for your testimony or informational presentation, Mr. Moat. We really look forward to you moving here full time. We do need your income from your income tax, so we're really looking forward to you moving here full time from Washington to Oregon.
I've realized just how much more that is for the sales tax I'm currently paying.
Yeah. So we're seriously, though, we appreciate it and we look forward to working with you.
Great. We're going to ask Angus Duncan, Chair of the Global Warming Commission, to join us. And for Dr. Moat and the other presenters, if we could get a copy of your presentations electronically, if you could send those to the committee administrator, that would be great. They can then forward them to committee members. Thank you.
Welcome. And some of you have heard Angus Duncan's presentation before. I am going to ask you to do a brief overview of the Global Warming Commission for some of our new members.
Sure. So, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, my name is Angus Duncan. I am president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation, and I also chair the Oregon Global Warming Commission, which you created in the 2007 session. I appreciate your scheduling this briefing. It probably says something about the state's revenue picture that you're coming to a climate briefing for good news. As it turns out, I think we do have at least a couple of items of good news for you. Phil Moat is certainly one, and I will be shorter than he because I know far less than he does, but we are extremely fortunate to have lured him down south. I think he just gave up on that football team up there, as well he should have. The second piece of good news is to let you know, as we will in a formal report shortly, that of the three goals that the advisory group on global warming recommended to the state back in 2004 that you adopted into legislation back in 2007, the first one was that by 2010 we wanted to have arrested the growth in emissions of greenhouse gases from Oregon and bend that line back downwards. By 2020 we wanted to be 10% below 1990 levels, and by 2050 at least 75% below 1990 levels. The analysis that the Department of Energy has done on the impact of legislative actions from 2007 and from a number of administrative actions and a lot of the work that goes on within private business and local governments is that we will in fact meet our 2010 goal. We will have leveled off our emissions of greenhouse gases, and we were on a track to do that even before we got this recession assist. I don't recommend any of us rely on that because recessions, for better or worse, do end, and greenhouse gas emissions continue to accumulate. So, Madam Chair, I'm going to provide testimony in three parts today. First, a brief account of the activities and products of the Global Warming Commission. Second, a discussion of the Commission's recommendation to the legislature on carbon cap and trade. And third, a summary of what I regard as the core questions the legislature needs to ask and answer in its consideration of the Western Climate Initiative framework on carbon cap and trade. You established our commission in 2007 with a considerable breadth of responsibilities, pretty much left it to the commission to figure out how those responsibilities would be discharged. And what we chose to do in 2008 is to do less original work and more look for collaborative opportunities with existing boards, commissions, agencies, stakeholder groups, where those groups were already engaging issues of carbon emissions and preparation for the changes global warming is already bringing. At the end of last year, the Commission and its stakeholder committees, dozens upon dozens of Oregon citizens that were involved, had looked at transportation, energy efficiency, renewable energy, fish and wildlife, agriculture, forestry, water, land use, and carbon cap and trade. Most of the stakeholders and state policymakers involved in these processes understood the importance of weaving climate considerations that we suggested into their recommendations, and in turn, we're glad that our commission has been able to not just help shape, but to also endorse by formal resolution most of those recommendations that are now before you as deserving of legislative approval, in some cases we will have added qualifications or additional recommended actions. And these resolutions are being forwarded to the legislature in our biennial report required by the legislation. We expect that to be available for you within the next 3 to 4 weeks. We also have an aggressive agenda that we are looking at for 2009 that will focus on the research agenda with Dr. Moat, on forests, on land use, on the role of local governments in managing both mitigation and adaptation, and in communications with and among Oregonians on climate issues, trying to create and engage that kind of a forum. Last week, the Commission considered the last of our resolutions on the advisability of Oregon moving forward with the Western Climate Initiative proposed framework for a regional carbon cap and trade. Through last summer and last fall, the Commission and its Energy and Utilities Committee has involved a broad cross-section of stakeholders, considering the many questions that arise in developing such an important and a complicated initiative. Parties often disagree vigorously on how Oregon should proceed, but that was appropriate because it's a difficult issue. There are lots of opinions, and we need to wrap them together to come up with constructive solutions. In the end, last week, the Commission voted 7-1, quote, that Oregon continue to move forward with the development of the WCI proposed framework for establishing a regional greenhouse gas cap and trade mechanism and complementary programmatic and regulatory measures, unquote. In addition to that overall recommendation, our resolution suggests ways in which the legislature could condition an authorization to the executive branch to proceed with rulemaking. We identify first 5 areas in which the legislature should expand programmatic tools to support greenhouse gas reductions, and we provide in some detail questions we believe remain to be addressed either by the WCI or the state of Oregon, answers to which will determine the fairness and the effectiveness of any cap and trade. These fall into 4 areas. First, allocation of allowances to emit greenhouse gases must treat each state and each regulated party within each state fairly and with the least possible effect on interstate competitive balance. Secondly, allowance trading markets must be designed for transparency, predictability, and integrity. Opportunities for market manipulation can and must be contained. Third, while most Oregonians should benefit from lower energy costs and new job opportunities, some Oregon households and businesses are likely to be adversely affected. Low-income households and energy-intensive businesses in particular, the state must target these households and businesses for special assistance as they, along with the rest of us, transition to a low-carbon economy. And fourth, the reliability of our energy supply systems, above all the electrical grid, must be ensured. The Commission emphasized that, and I quote, these are issues to be addressed constructively and satisfactorily resolved as we move forward, unquote. So they should not be construed as reasons to delay or to defer. That's the testimony from the Commission. The balance of my testimony is not based on formal Commission action, and so you should construe this as my own.
And I guess I hope it'll be possible in the interest of time for you simply to summarize very quickly your remaining testimony. I know that we'll have the opportunity to hear from you again if when we're hearing bills related to these subjects, and look forward to that. I want to make sure that we have time for at least a couple of questions. So that might mean summarizing now in the space of a minute or two.
I appreciate that, and I'll at least see if I can do that. So first question, why a carbon cap and trade? Why not a carbon tax? Wouldn't that be simpler? And the answer is a tax is rarely simpler. In this case, it is particularly an issue because of the difficulty of getting the tax level right to result in the right level of carbon emissions. So you can probably count on being back here regularly to adjust the tax level if you do a carbon tax. it is important, as you could infer from Phil's testimony, that we get the carbon emissions and the carbon reductions right. It is particularly important we do so because and do so in a way that is predictable for households and for businesses so that they can plan their budgets, particularly their longer-term investment budgets, with some notion for how their energy and their carbon consumption is going to be treated. So I think that a carbon cap and trade, I think the Commission does, gets us to those needed reductions without having to go back and reset the dial on a regular basis. So why not just do a carbon cap? Wouldn't that be simpler than getting into the trading mechanism? Congressman DeFazio raised this one in an op-ed today. And I think the answer is that, yes, markets can be complicated, are complicated. They can be manipulated, and from time to time, they are manipulated. That doesn't mean that anybody is out there calling for a repeal of market mechanisms as a way of doing business. When they are transparent, when they are well-regulated, when the integrity of markets is protected, then they are the most efficient way we have of completing transactions. We've seen a meltdown in the mortgage market in the last 6 months. Nobody, to my knowledge, is calling for a revocation of the right or responsibility of banks to issue mortgages. What they're calling for is banks to figure out how to issue those mortgages and manage them fairly and effectively and without imposing risks on the rest of us. Should we go forward if federal action is imminent? Good question. We engaged that one on the Commission, and the Commission unanimously supported and supports national action on climate. We're not so sure that it's imminent. Article in the New York Times this morning was especially interesting in taking a look at the map of the United States and figuring out where all the coal is burned. It's about 75% east of the Mississippi River, and there are senators and representatives, you know, when it comes to climate action, which will not be so much Democrat as Republican, as carbon-intensive states and carbon-non-intensive states trying to engage this issue and figure out where middle ground is. Second, we think the best way for Oregon and other Western states to end up with fair treatment under national cap and trade system, one that recognizes the particularities of our energy systems by devising our own cap and trade, identifying where those issues are, and making sure that they are visible in the national debate. One quick example, we're very dependent on hydropower here. Hydro years are wet and dry, as you saw from Phil's slides, and they're going to be wetter and drier as time goes on. If we had, for example, a national cap and trade where the compliance period was year by year, and we've got a wet year, we're fine. We're very low carbon. Dry year next year, we're in a lot of trouble. We're out buying in the market, and we're probably buying high carbon resources, and we're in violation. That puts us on a boom-bust cycle that we don't need to be on. So we need to make sure that a national cap and trade recognizes the particularities of the hydro cycle. I think probably the most important reason for moving early is that if we want to be in advance, in the front edge of a low-carbon economy, if we want to make the investments that make our businesses and our workers competitive, we don't do that by huddling in the back of the pack. Good example, Vestas, which is one of our large employers here in the state of Oregon now. 25 years ago, it was a relatively small tractor company in Denmark that started in making wind turbines, and they are now one of the largest wind turbine manufacturers globally because they started early, they invested, they anticipated the market. Let me just finish with the last question here, but what about cost? How do we make these kinds of investments in the middle of a recession? If we have a cap and trade, if we have moved to structure it, we can build flexibility into a cap and trade that allows us to slow our investments in weak economies and accelerate them in strong ones and give everybody the predictability and the flexibility to try to deal with the ups and downs of the economy while continuing to make our carbon reductions year in and year out. This is a long-term commitment we are making, and we simply can't let the immediate drive out the important in this case. The cost of shifting from a carbon-based economy of the last 200 years to one that relies on new fuels and technologies will not be insignificant, nor will the rewards. They'll be very like the changes that were made 200 years ago when we shifted into a fossil fuel economy. Some businesses were left behind, some had to adapt, and the country and the world prospered in consequence. We really need to make sure that we are anticipating these changes, because these changes are clearly on their way. As the Commission, I think, made clear in its recommendations to the legislature, there are certainly going to be distributive cost effects that will affect businesses and households, some of them disproportionately. Any equitable carbon reduction strategy has to make provision for these effects. These are real people, they're real businesses, and we recognize that. But no meaningful carbon reduction strategy can hold itself hostage to these effects. Acting firmly, acting fairly, acting above all with dispatch is the course that you and we should take and hold to. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Angus. I'm going to start with questions on the Senate side. Are there any questions for Mr. Duncan?
I don't have a question.
Well, we were hoping you were still out of the room, actually, Senator Wynn. Okay, go ahead.
I'm just saying, this is really fine and wonderful, but what I understand is that just to implement this program, it's like $1.5 million general fund and $400,000 of other funds, and we're going to be in a situation in this body where we can't even fund existing programs, so how are we going to fund new programs? So, I mean, this might just be an exercise and wonderful thing. The other thing, one question, you're talking about carbon offsets, and since I'm from an agriculture area, has there been any studies about agriculture's place in this situation as far as being a sink for carbon dioxide, and what is that science based on and that type of stuff?
Yeah. So I think the short answer to that question is clearly forests are sinks. Trees that are on long rotations are probably sinks, but we at this point, I don't think, are comfortable that we understand the science sufficiently to value those as sinks. And one of the priorities of the Commission in the coming year is going to be to focus in particularly on forests, both their vulnerability to climate change and how we manage for that, and their potential to be contributors to reducing greenhouse gases. And that's both as potential carbon sinks and as potential sources of biomass for fueling biomass energy generation. And we want to fully explore both of those. I think fundamentally, when I look at the landscape, I see that the greatest opportunities for reducing greenhouse gases through energy efficiency are in urban areas. That's where people live together, close by, the transportation efficiencies can be captured. I see most of the opportunities for renewable energy development in rural areas. That's where the wind is, that's where the biomass is, that's where most of the sun is, that's where the wave and tidal action is. So I think there's some real opportunities for Oregon, both urban Oregon and rural Oregon, to find opportunities to move forward with mitigation activities, and forests are clearly going to have to be one of them.
How about cropland, too?
And there is clearly an ability to sink carbon into land that is not tilled on a regular basis. I mean, dirt is one of the places where carbon accumulates. If you keep turning over the soil, you release the carbon. If you go to, for example, no-till agriculture and potentially some lower fertilizer agricultural regimes, there are some real opportunities to reduce carbon emissions and to take up carbon. And there may be an opportunity to, in effect, market those carbon sinks. They are being done in some markets right now. We don't do them at our foundation because of the difficulty of measuring them still.
Thank you. I have a question before we move over to the House members. You talked about the cost of the program, and Senator Nelson brought up costs, and you talked about the timing, that this partially depends on the timing. Do you have any data that looks at what's the cost of inaction? In other words, responding to if we have sea level changes or if we're changing our water supply and snowpack, timing of flooding, things like that. Have you done any analysis looking at, or you know of data that's available? Because I feel like we need to have that data in order to compare it with the cost of implementing the programs.
There are data available on a global and a national basis. Those kinds of analyses have been done. I don't think we've done it on a cumulative basis here in Oregon, and that's going to be a part of our research agenda that we're going to work through with Dr. Moat. I will tell you that the analyses that we have seen up to now, the British government is going to talk about the Stern report, which suggests that the costs to adapt to climate change are multiples of the cost to reduce emissions, anywhere from 5 times to as much potentially as 20 times the cost. There has been a similar analysis done, I think it was done by Tufts University for the United States, that suggested that our cost of adaptation was probably more in the range of 3.5% of GDP. Whereas almost all of the analyses that we have seen of the cost of mitigation, that is the cost of making changes in our energy systems and elsewhere to contain and reduce greenhouse gas emissions, were much more in the range of plus or minus 1% of GDP. That's a lot of money nationally. That's on a $14 trillion economy, that's about $140 billion a year. But we could meet that cost simply by increasing the fuel efficiency of our vehicle fleet by about 50%, from 27 or 28 miles per gallon right now up to about 40. Technology for that is available. That's about $140 billion a year. And I just use that as one example. There are many.
I know my committee members are cognizant of the time and the agenda, but if there is one quick question, we can...
Your burning questions?
Take that. Okay, let's... Please.
Great. Thank you.
And I think Bob Doppelt is going to speak a little bit to some of those costs specific to Oregon.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Seeing you more in the future. I just want to mention that we're going to have a little change in the agenda because Janice Deer from the state of Washington is only available for another few minutes. So we're going to actually hear first from the states of Washington and California, and then we'll go back to hear from the actions of the United Kingdom. So do we need to dial her in? Do you have Janice on board?
Almost.
Okay. Janice Adair is a special assistant to Director Jay Manning at the Washington Department of Ecology. Hello, Janice? Okay, great. We just have to turn up the volume here. This is Senator Dingfelder, and I'm here with Representative Cannon. We have a joint hearing today, both the Senate and House Environment Committees. We really appreciate you taking the time. I know you're in session as well and also very busy. We really wanted to hear today from you about what the status of programs, your involvement with the Western Climate Initiative in Washington, and also can maybe give us an update on legislation in Washington as well.
You have about
5 to 10 minutes because we'd like to leave a couple minutes for questions.
All right, okay, thank you. There's a little bit of a lag between your talking and my hearing. Hopefully this will work okay.
Okay.
We do have quite a bit going on in Washington. We have had two different groups, not unlike your Global Warming Commission, that have looked at ways for the state to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions in addition to the policies we already have in place, many of which Oregon also has, like the California tailpipe standards, the renewable portfolio standard. We've been focusing on transportation fuels, transportation emissions. That is our largest source of emissions. And have had some considered work taking place on that. Electrical vehicles, not unlike what Oregon has done. Waste management is another area that we have been focusing on. Our biggest policy issue will be developing and implementing the cap and trade program that we have designed in cooperation with Oregon and the other five states besides the two of us that are in the Western Climate Initiative and the four Canadian provinces. Our governor will be introducing legislation tomorrow, a fairly comprehensive bill that will set us on the path to implementing that program. I have been listening into some of the testimony today, and like you, there's a lot of concerns here about the cost, about doing this now when the economy is what it is. But we do feel like, as Angus said, that this is, we can't wait to take these actions, that once the economy turns around, we will see emissions go back up, and we want to make sure that our businesses are well-positioned to be in a competitive advantage, particularly compared to those businesses and entities that may not be thinking about this, because they're not living here and experiencing some of the effects of global warming that we have been experiencing here in the Pacific Northwest. We have also been looking at our state Environmental Policy Act so that we can start implementing thought around how development projects can increase greenhouse gases. We have seen losses coming out of California and Massachusetts, and we'd like to forestall policy by court and really be more thoughtful about how we use our current planning processes to be more considerate about greenhouse gas emissions in these types of projects. That has proved to be not quite as difficult as cap and trade, but a very very difficult issue, not so much in identifying where greenhouse gas emissions might occur, but rather how you might mitigate the impacts of those emissions from a development project. So there's just a tremendous amount of work going on. We will be asking our building council to improve the building code by another 30% efficiency. We will be asking our clean tech businesses to join with the administration in working on some policies and planning for that clean energy future that we know is coming. And lastly, the state will be walking its talk by implementing a number of energy efficiency and greenhouse gas reduction strategies amongst all of the executive branch agencies. In the interest of your time and mine, I'd be happy to stop there and answer any questions.
Great. Are there questions from members of the House Committee for...
Okay. Any questions from members of the Senate Committee? Yes, we have one from Senator Przanski.
Could you tell us where you're at in implementing these? It sounds like you've been in a planning stage for a couple of years. How long did it take you to get to where you're at today?
We've had a climate action team for a couple of years. They started out with about 47 recommendations, narrowed that down to a suite of about 16. Many of those have been proposed. Some have been adopted by our legislature. It really is the cap and trade program, which is the centerpiece of our policy, that we will be focusing on during this legislative session. And that has been the product of about 18 months of work within the Western Climate Initiative process.
Okay. Other questions? And do you have any?
Janice, this is Representative Cannon. I wonder what type of coordination you are continuing to undertake with the other WCI states as each state goes a somewhat different route via legislation to authorize and begin to implement WCI. What are you doing to help mitigate the risk that there would be real lack of harmony in the state's approach?
One of the things that probably the most important thing that we've done is the design that the WCI put out in late September really does identify those things that need to be consistent between the jurisdictions, in order to have a functional market. We have to be sending the same price signals. Our allowances have to have the same value in order to, for them to be fungible between our states and provinces. So, well, we are all continuing to work within the WCI construct on some of those details. We are talking to one another about our legislative proposals. We are all looking at one another's legislative proposals to make sure that we haven't misinterpreted or gone awry in any of the elements we've included in our legislation. Ours in Washington will be quite detailed. We will be not only reiterating some of the specific design features of the WCI, but in those areas where the state can pursue its own course, we will be providing some fairly specific direction to the Department of Ecology on those things as well. At the end of the day, certainly any legislator, as you know, can make whatever changes that they feel is necessary to a piece of legislation, and the ultimate outcome of that may be that we can't participate in the market because we have made some change to our legislation that would impact our ability to participate in the market. All we can do is point that out if those changes are being proposed and let folks know the impact of those changes. But we're really hoping not to have to do that, because there is a tremendous interest in our business community that any cap and trade program we implement be a regional, at least a regional, if not a national cap and trade program.
Thank you, Janice.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions before we say goodbye to Janice and let her get back to her legislative duties in Washington? Okay, we really appreciate your calling in, and good luck. We will definitely be keeping in close contact with you and with the committee staff up there.
Well, great. Thank you very much, and thank you for your time.
Great.
Yes, next we're going to invite Anthony Eggert from California Air Resources Board to join us and get a little update on California's approach to climate change.
Thank you. Chair Dingfelder, Chair Cannon, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present California's programs here today. I am the senior policy advisor to the chair of the Air Resources Board, which is the agency with primary authority to construct the program, which is the result of our legislation, the Global Warming Solutions Act, which was passed in 2006. I will try to be brief, so if there's any questions, that we have time for those. I want to just quickly give an overview of California's program, to talk about sort of the strong need to collaborate on a regional and federal scale, and then look forward to how we see this program sort of evolving. Very recently, there was a study that came out of UC Berkeley, which I think was very similar to the types of information that was presented by Dr. Mode in terms of the potential impacts to our state. They are quite severe. The study estimates that as much as half of the state's real estate, $4 trillion worth of real estate, is potentially at risk from extreme weather events, sea level rise, and wildfires. We're already seeing the effects of climate change within the state through an increase of both the frequency and intensity of wildfires. And so this is not just sort of an altruistic pursuit. We do see that there's going to be potentially real damage to our state economy if we don't take action. We also believe that taking action can be a tremendous opportunity for the state, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Recently the board adopted and approved a scoping plan, which basically lays out all of the policies, measures, and mechanisms that we see are necessary to achieve the goal, which is a 30% reduction from business as usual by 2020. It's important to note, in California, as I believe here in Oregon, this is just a sort of a milestone towards what we see as necessary to achieve our contribution to a stable climate, which is about an 80% reduction in emissions by 2050. So as we're designing our policies, we're looking to that future and trying to make sure that they're sufficiently durable to sustain ourselves, to sustain through a reduction of that magnitude. In terms of process, the development of the rules were part of an extensive stakeholder-driven process that lasted almost 2 years, hundreds of meetings with affected stakeholders, industry groups, and the result, we believe, is a fairly balanced mix of market-based mechanisms, basically source-specific performance requirements, that we think is going to lead us towards a transition to a clean energy economy. This is largely an outgrowth of a long-standing set of policies that have driven energy efficiency gains in the state that have resulted in substantial savings to the state. And really our plan is based on the foundation of continuing that trend towards increased energy efficiency in everything that we do. We did do a fairly extensive economic analysis on the plan. There's also an analysis that just came out today that was sponsored by Next10, which I think confirms a lot of our conclusions, which is that if done right, and I think that's an important caveat, that this could result in a substantial economic boon to the state in terms of several billions of dollars in money saved, largely through reduced energy costs and expenditures on energy that gets reinvested back into the state economy, as well as over 100,000 new jobs estimated. Already we've been the beneficiary partially through our policies, in that over half of the clean tech venture capital invested in this country is invested in California, over about $3.3 billion. So just to talk about the policies in brief, I'm an engineer, and I like to sort of take things apart into their component parts. And if you look at the generation of greenhouse gas emissions, you have the carbon intensity or the GHG intensity of the energy supply that you use, the efficiency of how you convert that energy into a service or a product, and then finally the end use, the use of that product. And if you multiply those together, you'll get the greenhouse gas emissions associated with any particular sector. Transportation is our largest sector, as is Oregon's and Washington's. I'll just take a second to focus on that. We do see policies in each of those areas, including low-carbon fuel standard, which I know is being considered here, that requires a reduction of 10% in the life cycle emissions associated with fuel sold into the state. And what's really important about that particular policy is that we believe it's necessary to drive the investments to create the diversity of fuels, low-carbon fuels, that we think will be necessary to transition ourselves to a low-carbon transportation system. The other important component of it is a life cycle standard, which looks at all aspects of producing the fuel, including emissions that are generated outside of the state. This is paired with our vehicle program, which I think many are you familiar with and also have adopted here in Oregon. We were very encouraged to hear our President Obama direct his EPA to reconsider the denial of California's waiver. We expect quick action on that and should soon be able to implement that program. And then finally, just a brief word, we also do see a lot of potential in addressing the demand side for vehicle travel. We had a piece of legislation that was passed at the end of last year. Our Senate leader, Steinberg, that basically sets up an incentive system to drive transportation planning and jobs and housing development in a direction that provides for reduced congestion, reduced vehicle travel, greater mode choice, provision of transit, walking and biking. And also we do provide some incentives despite our financial challenges. We do seed investment, for example, in fuels. We have a program of about $100 million a year to invest in those that we think hold the most promise. Let's see. Similarly, in power generation and the other sectors, policies that address the carbon intensity of the energy supply, the efficiency of the use, and the end-use demand are all inherent in our measures across all sectors. And then finally, overlaying across all of this, we've proposed, along with our WCR partner jurisdictions, which includes Oregon, to develop an economy-wide cap-and-trade program covering greater than 85% of our total emissions within the state. As has already been described, how this would work, it basically puts a constraint on the total amount of emissions. That constraint creates a market price. And when you look at the way these things work together, the performance standards and the price on carbon created through the market, they're actually very nice complements to each other. The price on carbon makes efficiency more profitable. It makes low-carbon fuels more attractive on a relative basis. And the combination of these performance standards and the cap-and-trade program, we think, is going to deliver the reductions that we need to reach the target. A quick word on collaboration. We think it's because of the global nature of the challenge, it's necessary that we do collaborate with partners outside of our borders. Certainly the WCI is sort of a shining example of this. By having a broader coverage, we both increase the effectiveness of our program, greatly increasing the reductions that we could achieve alone. And there's a number of other advantages. By creating that uniform price across these jurisdictions, we reduce the potential for leakage, meaning businesses wanting to transfer outside of our state to avoid coverage of our programs. The market is likely to discover opportunities that we as regulators currently can't envision. And I can come back more to that if there's interest. And then finally, also has been mentioned, we do expect a federal program to emerge under the leadership of the new president and the new Congress. And we see the great advantage of helping to define our own regional program in a way that sort of expresses our needs and our desires for what we think a good program should look like. Finally, looking into the future, really the way we see this is that it's the businesses and industries that are going to be actually doing this transition. It's going to require the investment of our current and future business communities to actually develop the products that are going to actually reach the goals, that are going to continue to be able to provide people goods and services that they want and need, but at a much lower impact to the climate. And so I'll stop there and see if there's any questions. Thank you.
Questions from this side of the dais. You're all so quiet today. I appreciate that.
It's getting late, I can tell. Questions from any of the senators? Senator Nelson? Okay. Well, we really appreciate you coming. We do realize you had other business in Oregon, but we certainly appreciate the fact that you were able to come to Salem today. And we also, as with Washington, look forward to working with you, working closely with you, as you have been doing work on this for several years, and we certainly want to make sure that we're coordinating. That's the whole point of making sure we're talking to our neighbors in the North and South on a regular basis.
Thank you.
Thank you. And that, I just wanted to let colleagues know, we're going to work through this agenda. We hope to get you out here. It's probably just going to be a few minutes after 5, so we apologize. We have a late start. So we're going to keep working through and want to make sure that we hear from everybody on the agenda today. I'm going to ask, Annabelle Mallins, is that how you say your last name, and Bob Doppel to come up together just for timing's sake. But Annabelle, I think we're going to hear from you first about the overview of actions in the UK.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you especially to for allowing me to come and represent the views of UK government on this very important issue that the committees are going to be considering in this session. My name is Annabelle Mallins. I'm the Consul for Science and Innovation based in San Francisco, which is the British Consulate General responsible for our outreach in the western states, including Oregon. Climate change is a top priority issue for the UK. It's a major driver of our domestic policy, but it's also a top priority for us internationally. And I guess on my title slide here, it might give a hint as to why, you know, it is an important international priority for us. This is a rather sad picture of a rural area of the UK that was subjected to recent flooding. Despite that image, the major problem that we have in the UK, which we think is linked to climate change, is actually water shortage and drought. that's our big problem, and we have, together with that, erratic rainfall, which is leading to very disruptive flooding, which is affecting, not only causing social and community distress, but also disrupting business and having other sort of wider economically damaging impacts. So climate change is with us. The bad news for us is that although we're responsible for 2% of global emissions in the UK, however hard we try to tackle our own emissions, that's not going to be enough to avoid the damaging impacts of climate change. So very much at the heart of our thinking is that we need to work in collaboration with others to address this issue, and the whole of our diplomatic network globally is aimed at developing collaborations with other countries, other regions, other states that are taking leadership positions on climate change and implementing measures to mitigate climate change. I just wanted to give a quick overview of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to flick through a few slides. I will try and keep it short, and if I touch on 10 minutes, I hope somebody will wave a red flag at me. The global context is also important, particularly as we're approaching the end of the current international agreement, the Kyoto Protocol, which sets out some obligations on signatories on reducing their emissions. There's a major meeting that takes place in Copenhagen at the end of 2009, and that is what we've focused on in terms of gaining agreement on a comprehensive international agreement which will set a long-term framework for action. Boiling things down in terms of what's needed to address climate change, we think there are three sort of main ingredients, and forgive me those of you that realize this is a gross simplification. One of the dimensions that need to be addressed is pricing carbon. That can be achieved either by tax, by emissions trading, or by regulation. Another very important aspect is investment in the low carbon technologies we need to sustain and develop our economies. And the third is public engagement, because we really need our consumers, our general public, to understand the link between their individual decisions, their day-to-day choices, and the impact on greenhouse gas emissions. So those are three facets which underlie our approach in our domestic policy, as well as what we hope will be achieved through an international agreement. I'm going to talk a little bit about cap and trade, because I know that's something that is absorbing a lot of the discussion here in the United States, and particularly within the Western Climate Initiative, and just give you a quick pen picture of progress within the UK and Europe on our climate change emissions mitigation, and the lessons that we've learned along the way. And part of the main part of my role here in San Francisco is to facilitate exchanges on climate and energy issues, to try and share the lessons that we've learned, and shorten learning curves where possible for other parts of other states and other organizations which are seeking to address climate change. First message I just wanted to mention was that, listening into the debate here, it tends to focus very much on cap and trade, as if it's the only show in town, and it's, should we have cap and trade, should we not? In the UK and in Europe, it is a very important part of our climate change program, but it's certainly not the only part. We have a number of other instruments which we use to reduce emissions. We even have some that, can easily be labelled as a tax. And we've found ways to implement those which have been very effective in reducing emissions, but not just in reducing emissions. They've also been very effective in focusing boardroom decision makers on how to reduce energy consumption in their businesses and effectively make them more competitive by finding new cost savings through energy efficiency. We've tackled renewable energy. We have a mechanism within the UK called the Renewables Obligation, which has a trading element within it. We have voluntary agreements, which are sectorally based agreements for business who adopt challenging targets and gain rebates in their energy tax, the climate change levy. We have standards. We have a aspiration to have all new domestic builds zero carbon by 2016, and we also have targets for our government and public buildings. We also have a major program on public outreach and involvement. I also just wanted to highlight that in November last year, the Queen gave royal assent to three major new pieces of legislation which will underpin our climate change policies going forward. One of those is called the UK Climate Change Bill, which actually for the first time sets a legally binding target for 2050 of an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions from 1990 baseline. It also makes a legal commitment to achieve at least a 26% reduction in CO2 emissions by 2020. It introduces the concept of having five-year carbon budgets, which are sort of set out in three sets at a time. So it provides business certainty on what the investment climate will be over a 15-year period. It also sets up some institutional arrangements, including an expert committee to advise government on how sectors should be targeted, where the burdens should lie across different sectors of UK business, and it provides some new powers for government for introducing secondary legislation. Importantly, it also addresses adaptation and sets out requirements on how plans for risk management for climate change should be taken on, and it also sets out the requirements to provide accountability to UK Parliament. Also, late last year, there was an important agreement by the EU heads of state. And I wanted just to point this out because, you know, this is a time as where we were already very aware of the economic turmoil that EU heads of government were facing, and yet they did sustain their political commitment on some very ambitious targets, not only for greenhouse gas emissions but also for expanded renewable energy, and this was seen to be a very strong indication that the current economic problems are not a reason to turn away from addressing climate change. They're actually a reason to get on and deliver it in order to reshape the economies and better fit them for future growth. Apart from committing to a 20% reduction from 1990 levels by 2020 on a unilateral basis, EU heads of government also committed to delivering a 30% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions if international agreement is reached. There's also some changes to strengthen the EU emissions trading scheme, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that, as well as a commitment that 20% of all energy, not just all electricity generation, will come from renewable sources. So that encompasses energy used for transport and so on.
Ms. Malins, I'm sorry, will be in danger of touching on that 10-minute here shortly.
The EU emissions trading scheme tends to get a lot of bad press, so I thought I'd just throw something in here about why on earth did we go ahead and choose this measure if it was such a flawed instrument. In fact, we did find that across the 27 member states of Europe, it was politically much easier to agree on emissions trading than it was to agree a tax. In fact, we did try to debate having a tax across Europe initially. It also meant that Europe could develop an instrument to deliver the cap that it had accepted under the Kyoto Protocol. It was seen to be a more cost-effective method of delivering emissions, and we've heard a little bit about business preference, in fact, for cap and trade as a mechanism. And it was important in terms of delivering a level playing field for business across the member states of Europe. And of course, we looked at the experience that the US had already acquired in cap and trade. I won't go into the details of the cap and trade scheme because I'm sure you're quite familiar with those. I would just like to mention, though, some of the features of the EU emissions trading scheme in terms of what it took on. It is a very complex requirement to set in place a scheme which will run across national boundaries. At the time it was initiated, it covered 25 member states, now 27 member states. That encompasses 20 official languages across that geographic area. It covered 12,000 emitters. It was responsible for tackling more than 2 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide a year. And across the member states of Europe, there's very varied GDP per capita. So, for example, Bulgaria and Romania are probably on a par with Mexico, whereas, of course, the UK, France and Germany are much more in the territory of the US GDP per capita. So in terms of trying to find an instrument that could cover all those different stages of economic growth, you know, the EU ETS really had to be able to take that on. In fact, we assessed the initial stages of implementation of the EU emissions trading scheme as having been successful. It did put in place new institutions in a very rushed timetable. It was the implementation went through a pilot stage, a three-year stage, before it had to deliver on the emission reductions that were required under the Kyoto Protocol, and in fact there has been a very high level of compliance which has set us in good stead for the current phase, which runs from 2008 to 2012, the Kyoto compliance period. We have learned some lessons. There was not real scarcity in the market initially, which meant that the price bottomed out, zeroed out practically in the first phase. And one of the reasons for that was we didn't have good baseline data, which we've now been able to rectify. There were issues around competitive distortions because of lack of harmonisation in the way in which the scheme was operated in different member states. And so harmonisation, we think, is a golden rule in working across boundaries, as we are doing. And another important lesson was, of course, that business needs certainty, and for that reason the EU is pressing ahead with extending this scheme into a third phase from 2013 under a strengthened regime. And just to finish off on a high note, I just thought I'd show a very flattering chart of UK emissions from our baseline year of 1990 through to the current year and projected out to 2020. For those of you that can see, our Kyoto target is indicated on this chart in terms of, and you can see that we've already overshot our Kyoto target. In fact, we've exceeded the target already, and we may actually more than double the achievement at the end of the commitment period. But we're not at all satisfied with the progress we're making. All the science is telling us we need to go further and we need to go faster, and hence, you know, we are continuing to strengthen our climate change program. Well, last week there was the announcement that the UK is now officially in economic recession, but I would like to say that it wasn't our climate policies that put us in that position. Okay. I'm going to close there. Great.
Thank you. And we're going to go on and take testimony from Mr. Doppelt, and then we'll take questions. But, you know, we're hoping that maybe we can do a field trip during the interim to come see your program. So, of course, all members would have to pay for that themselves, but we'd certainly look forward to working with you and hearing more about how the UK is progressing on those policies. Mr. Doppelt, thank you for coming today.
Chair Dingfelder and Chair Cannon, thank you for having me here. I'm going to talk about the other side of the pond now, our side here. For the record, I'm Bob Doppelt. I direct the Climate Leadership Initiative and Resource Innovations at the University of Oregon. We are a social science-based climate research institute. We work very closely with Phil Moat and the biophysical science folks. And I want to share three pieces of information with you today. First, I want to summarize an analysis we have completed of the impacts of climate change in the Rogue Basin of Oregon and in the Upper Willamette Basin of Oregon, which includes Eugene Springfield area. Last year, my institute, with a number of other organizations around the state, began to assess the likely impacts of climate change in various basins of the state. We started in the Rogue. We moved to the Willamette. We are going to move over and begin an assessment in the Umatilla Basin in a couple of months, and then move to the Klamath, and we may then do the Deschutes and the lower Willamette. And we found that in the Rogue and the Willamette Basins, and I'm just going to give you a very brief overview of what we found, that both areas are likely to experience rising temperatures, increased storm events, prolonged summer droughts, more frequent and intense wildfires, and consequently a fairly significant shift in vegetation patterns, or at least the conditions that are likely to lead to different vegetation patterns. I'm giving you just an overview, but here are some examples of what we found in the Rogue. Average temperatures in the Rogue are likely to increase by 1 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit by 2040 and 4 to 8 degrees Fahrenheit by 2080 under a business-as-usual scenario, that is, no significant change in global emissions. And as Phil said earlier in the day, average summer temperatures are really likely to increase by 7 to 15 degrees above baseline by 2080. So the summers are going to get much warmer than they are now, and it's already hot down there. The models we used, and we downscaled IPCC climate models to these basins, predicted a 25 to 75% reduction in snowpack in the Rogue by 2040 and another 25 to 75% reduction by 2080 and a corresponding decline in runoff and in stream flows. In the Willamette, we found that the average temperature increase was going to be between 2 to 4 degrees by 2040 and 6 to 8 degrees by 2080. And although the snowpack and stream flow losses that are projected are not as extreme as they are in the Rogue, they are still pretty significant. The primary focus for reason for doing these studies is not just to understand the potential impacts from a biophysical point of view, but then to calculate what it means for the built environment, for our economy, and for human systems, and by that we mean emergency services, healthcare, etc. And so just to summarize, what we found in the Rogue and in the Willamette is that the ecological changes I just described are very likely to cause many millions of dollars in direct damage to buildings and transportation and other infrastructure. Disruptions in, it will disrupt the transportation of goods, especially in the flood events or larger fires. It'll increase demands for emergency services. It increased the likelihood of vector and waterborne diseases and heat-related illnesses. It will cause significant shifts in the economies in both regions and increase the vulnerability of natural systems. Those are the direct damages. The indirect consequences are likely to be much greater. I want to give you four recommendations that came out of these studies and then shift to the second comment. We organized stakeholders, including local government, state government representatives, public health officials, et cetera, to talk about what these likely changes would mean in each basin and ask them what they would recommend to begin to prepare for those changes. And they came up with four general recommendations. One is that, in fact, climate change preparation, formal steps to begin to prepare for climate change, should become a top priority of all government levels of government, the private sector, and households in each one of these areas, in these basins. Secondarily, policies and programs should be adopted based on a vulnerability analysis to build resiliency and build resistance to the coming changes, and that those policies and programs need to complement each other and ensure that they do not undermine each other. I think there's a great risk of that. Third, we should take steps now to begin to restore the capacity of the land to buffer some of the impacts that are likely to happen. So, for example, if you restore riparian areas along streams that are likely to be subject to increased flooding and wildfires, you may provide greater migration corridors for wildlife that are going to need to migrate as a result of increased temperatures and increased fire and drought. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, what we found is that to respond to these novel challenges that lie ahead, we're likely to need new forms of governance. I don't mean government, I mean governance. And that means new types of information is going to need to be gathered. We need to begin to think about allocating staff and equipment and other resources in different ways. And we need to adopt decision-making mechanisms that are more responsive to rapid change. So the bottom line, to make this short, and there's more information in the package I provided, is that it's very important to do our best to make sure the problem doesn't get worse, meaning we have to reduce greenhouse gases as judiciously as possible. But at the same time, we need to prepare. We need to begin to prepare for the coming changes that are now inevitable. And I think the preparation focus, or adaptation is another word for that, should be an important priority. The second issue I want to discuss very briefly with you is through our program on climate economics in my institute, we have initiated a study of the likely economic consequences of climate change for the entire state. We're also doing this for the state of Washington and for other WCI states. We're not quite done with the study. We're about 2 weeks out before it will be released, but I can share with you that it looks like our estimation of the direct cost of climate change for the state of Oregon is likely to be in the $5 billion plus range annually by 2020, and those costs will go up if warming continues to rise. And those are the direct costs. The indirect costs and the cumulative costs are likely to be much greater. I can share a lot more of that with you in about 2 or 3 weeks. And finally, I just want to point out a document that I've provided for you. It's called Setting the Record Straight here. This is a document that outlines some of the questions that have been asked about the science of climate change and some of the misinformation that's being passed around, and provides you with credible scientific responses to those challenges. I want to thank Phil Mote and other climate scientists at the University of Washington for helping us put this together. But it may prove useful as you begin to debate some of the legislation that you're engaged in. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Doppel. Are there any questions? We'll start on the Senate side for either of the panelists.
I just want to thank both of them for being here.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You lamented the lack of questions. I'll probably end up testing your indulgence here. Consul Malins, it's wonderful to have you here before the committee. I have a couple questions for you at the indulgence of the chair. The UK, what percentage of global output in CO2 would you say that the UK is responsible for? Do you have any sort of general estimate of that?
I'm afraid I only know the figure for greenhouse gases overall, which is around 2%. Right. I don't know for CO2 specifically. But I'm afraid, you know, we're probably a heavy culprit as an early industrialized, you know, nation.
Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yep.
And within the UK, are there subnational entities that have taken even stronger measures than the UK as a whole has agreed to, or England as a whole has agreed to?
Yes, I think across the UK population, there's a very high level of appreciation that global warming, climate change is a real issue and a big problem to be tackled. And there has been a lot of local government initiative to take local measures. We have one sort of star local government called the Borough of Woking to the west of London, who have successfully reduced their municipal emissions by, I think, more than 80% below 1990 level at this stage, may actually be higher than that, nearer to 90%. A number of other local governments have also, you know, made some very successful progress.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Thank you. So if the UK as a whole is responsible for approximately 2% of greenhouse gas emissions worldwide, and you have subnational entities that are, by definition, then responsible for less than that, and the UK as a whole is adopting a number of measures, or you spoke of a carbon tax, a carbon obligation, building standards, carbon budgets, and then there's a cap and trade overlay over all of that at a regional level. Obviously, these subnational entities in the UK can't solve the entire climate change problem on its own. Have you seen leakage of companies or businesses that have gone elsewhere? Do you have a national business group? Is there, have they come out with a position on this?
Business in the UK have been actually very, very much, very close in close dialogue with UK government in helping us to shape our policies. The Confederation of British Industry have actually lobbied UK government to be proactive in some areas which they felt could be addressed more ambitiously, and they felt that it their members favoured more proactive action to provide the kind of business investment certainty that they felt they needed. In terms of competitivity issues, there has been analysis looking at individual sectors and how they've been affected. There are some sectors which are more subjective to leakage, and I think that varies to some extent country by country, but I'd be very happy to share analysis which actually, you know, provides that overview as to which sectors may be most susceptible. In general, I think businesses have found that that climate change measures have had far less impact on their competitivity than they initially imagined.
Final follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So you've got this cap and trade overlay. We had an editorial in today's paper in the Oregonian talking a little bit about cap and trade at a federal level and discussing the experience of the European trading system. I believe a characterization in the editorial was that it had been less than successful because of gaming of the system and speculation within the system. In your experience, has that been successful? Are there ways to adapt to some of those problems? And would you characterize this as a success thus far for the UK?
I think it's very difficult in looking only at the first years of operation of the EU emissions trading scheme to actually assess whether or not it's been as successful as a market. We know that you know, there has been some quite serious price instability, mostly because of allowance overallocation, because of the lack of good data initially. But that was all the point of having a pilot stage, a first stage, which could be a learning phase, and there's been a lot of efforts made to ensure that the current phase two, will operate more successfully as a market, and it is showing every indication at the moment of doing so and of delivering real emission reductions. So jury's still out in terms of overall success. Let's have a look in 2012 at the end of the current phase, but European governments are generally very confident that they're onto a good thing and that this is a mechanism that will serve them well in delivering further emission reductions by tightening the cap of the emissions trading scheme into the future as a major component of their climate change policies.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Ms. Malins, too. London, I was in London recently, and my taxi driver got a ticket for not paying his tax. So I'm asking, what, if anything, I know Europeans tend to walk more and use more public transport than we do, and we all know that transportation here in the U.S. is probably the biggest in the larger cities area, not in the rural areas, but it's the bigger polluter overall. So what What difference has that made? And was that part of the plan to lower the carbon, or was it more of a congestion issue?
It depends who you ask. I've asked a few people, and I think that congestion charging or road pricing was initially introduced for congestion control. It has had a very useful side benefit in terms of emission reduction, and road pricing is a policy measure that's being explored more extensively within the UK and is being implemented in some other areas. But I think in terms of emission control from transport, the UK government is exploring a lot of other avenues, with that one only being a limited option.
Just a quick follow-up. Has that made a huge difference, though, in the use of drivers, of those who do drive into town and have to, put it this way, the taxis, et cetera, have to use it,
yes,
but other people don't?
Yes. I think what was most helpful about it is it really caught public attention. People really paid attention and understood what was going on, and it was very successful in that respect in terms of resulting in behaviour change. Whether or not it was all to do with publicity about the introduction of a new scheme and all the controversy around that, rather than the mechanism itself, I think is debatable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank both of you again for coming today. We appreciate, we know you've come long distances, some longer than others, but we certainly appreciate the information that you've shared with the committee today.
And I'm sorry, Madam Chair, before they step down, Representative Gilliam has one final
very quick, because we have 5 minutes left for our last speaker.
Is somebody else?
We do have one more person.
Well, then I think I'll just hold off. Thank you.
He'll remonstrate on the floor tomorrow.
Madam Chair, I understand you're going to give us the your
PowerPoint.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in your presentation one of the questions that one of the local communities actually is below, has exceeded their level down to 80%. Could you include in that what they've actually done at more of the local level as compared to what's happening on a countrywide basis?
They've focused on energy management. They've actually come off grid for a large part of their municipal power supplies, so local generation and distributed power networks, a large investment in solar power PV, which they've been able to finance through by coming off grid.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we may be the younger chamber, but we are not the lower chamber. Representative Gilliam, quick question.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
If he can get it out, we can hopefully hear it.
And thank you, Queen Chair. I just wanted to go back for a second, and thank you very much for being here, but we had to go through some of your slides rather quickly, and I just want to delve a little deeper into what Representative Bailey brought up. Your slides seem to refute the criticism that I've read or heard that phase one and putting together something like a cap and trade in any country, let alone the European Union, I'm sure is very difficult, but that phase one in fact raised emissions, or I should say during that period emissions went up, I'm sure not to the it was UK's fault, but in the EU's general cap and trade. Are you refuting that, or did those slides refute that? Is that how I read that?
I don't think my slides showed that emissions went up during that first phase. It was the way in which the phase one was designed was to achieve a reduction in emissions, but that was shared out across each member state. So in fact some countries were allowed to increase their emissions while others had to reduce their emissions in order to achieve an overall reduction. So in terms of evaluating what was delivered, one needs to look rather carefully about what's being summed up. Another issue that has been debated is about the extent to which emission reductions have been delivered domestically within an individual state as opposed to being purchased overseas. through international credits, and that has been contentious. Some countries chose to limit access quite severely, and the UK is one of those, to ensure that there was real action, domestic action, and limited access to international credits. Other countries were more lenient in that regard to their business, and I think that's also drawn criticism. In the second phase, which we're now currently in and we don't have a full evaluation for, there is more control over access to international credits. Not sure if that quite answers the question fully.
But it's obviously very complex, but I'm still not sure whether the jury's in or out on the first phase. And I'm also interested in, and we'll have to take it up at another time, the reference that we had to gaming and what are the natural tendency for folks to manipulate the system and hoard credits and jack up the price. And then ultimately, my concern, and I'm sure everyone's concern, is are we really helping the businesses that we're trying to, or does it actually harm them because of the gaming and other issues? So you may or may not want to comment on that. I'm sure that the Senate chair doesn't want you to.
Well, I think the Representative Bailey had already asked that question, but what I'm going to ask is if you can follow up maybe via email with my committee chair, and then we'll make sure that information gets out along with your PowerPoint presentation to all the members. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And last but not least, we're going to hear from the Governor's Office. David Vantoff is going to give a very brief overview in 5 minutes of the Western Climate Initiative and the Governor's Climate Change legislative package.
Madam Chair, Representative Cannon, members of the joint committees. I'll be real brief because I've got two handouts that hopefully have been distributed, both of my remarks, and then also short summaries of the bills that I'm going to briefly touch upon. And if there's any time for questions, happy to answer any of them. I'm going to skip through some of these remarks in the interest of time, but I would note that it was nice to see Washington and California representatives here, both in the context of, as was mentioned, the clean cars, California tailpipe waiver issue, having just been taking a major step in the direction of where we're all headed collectively in the West Coast. That was very good news in terms of some of our regional efforts to address the issue. And the other thing I would note is I wanted to provide a little bit of context before just touching on the governor's package of bills. And in that context, one of the first things that happened when the governor came into office was, in terms of his priorities, was developing a regional approach to addressing climate change and greenhouse gas reductions. And that resulted in 2003 in the three states, Washington, California, and Oregon, committing to work collectively and collaboratively on policy to achieve reductions. So the tailpipe standards was one example of that regional approach. And a few of the policies that you saw on the slides from Washington State and California, the renewable portfolio standards and approach to transportation, which I'll touch on, are things that we're looking at regionally as well. So there's been good collaboration already, and that 2003 effort grew into what is now being called the Western Climate Initiative. That has evolved into 7 Western states and 4 Canadian provinces that comprise roughly 80% of the Canadian economy and 20% of the United States economy. So it's become a large group, and on a scale similar to, I think, what we heard about in terms of the EU program and efforts. And in addition, it's got observers in the Western Climate Initiative. There's 4. The Mexican border states are all observers of the process. There's a chance that they may join, in which case we'd have a three nation, or at least representatives from states from three different nations participating in this one regional, large regional program. So it's that's just a little context. I'll touch on the WCI at the end of this. But in 2004, again, for some, you know, how do we get here steps, the governor created one of the nation's first global warming advisory groups. We heard about Washington having a similar process. That group was comprised of industry, utility, environmental faith and other stakeholders, and was very effectively co-chaired by Mark Dodson, then CEO of Northwest Natural, and Dr. Jane Lipchenko, who a renowned ocean and climate change scientist who we've heard recently was appointed by President Obama to head the NOAA agency. So it's exciting news. That advisory group, so back in 2004, developed a report of over 60 recommendations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It's cited here in terms of where links are if any committee members want to look at that report. And the governor endorsed that report at that time and has been working towards achieving key recommendations since that time. In 2005, the governor announced aggressive greenhouse gas reduction goals, California, Washington soon followed thereafter. Oregon's reduction goals, which then this legislature put into statute in the 2007 session, is to arrest the increase of emissions by 2010, to reduce emissions to 10% below 1990 levels by 2020, and to reduce emissions to 75% below 1990 levels by 2050. So those are among the more aggressive reduction goals that are anywhere in the by any states in the country. And it was a significant step. We talked briefly about the tailpipe standards happening. The governor directed the Environmental Quality Commission to enact those standards. That was done in the 2006 year process. And then, of course, the 2007 session was a landmark session where this legislature passed some of the most progressive environmental and climate change legislation that we've seen in this state. And some of the largest steps were with the Renewable Portfolio Standard and the Transportation Fuel Standard, the RFS and RPS, as we call them. But there was also other significant steps in terms of expansion of Oregon's investment in the energy efficiency through the Energy Trust of Oregon, expansion of the Business Energy Tax Credit that set the stage for a huge surge in solar manufacturing entering the state over the past 2 years. And then finally, creation of the Global Warming Commission and the Oregon Climate Change Research Institute, and you've heard from those the heads of both of those institutions today. In 2008, a second advisory group created by the governor, which is called the Climate Change Integration Group, developed another report. This group was focused, in addition to looking at how we were doing in terms of reducing emissions and mitigation, also developing the first attempts to look at adaptation and what the state should be doing around impacts from climate change long term. That report, again, is in the materials that you have that was delivered to the governor in 2008. And some of the good news from that report was that the measures taken in between 2005 and through the 2007 session were projected to have helped Oregon to achieve its 2010 goal already, or at least being on track to achieve the 2010 goal of arresting emissions. So we've taken really major steps forward as a state, and this legislature deserves a lot of credit for how far we have come. But the flip side of that is we've got a long ways to go, and this 2009 session is, in the governor's view, the time that we really need to take major additional steps forward if we're going to achieve our long-term reduction goals. And so the climate change package that he's developed and is promoting is just that. It's a comprehensive approach to how to achieve reductions and grow the economy over the next 20-year period. So the governor's climate package, and there's in the materials a little bit of tooting our own horn in terms of what we've accomplished from particularly renewable energy and energy efficiency perspective. I won't belabor that, but again, the solar energy manufacturing sector, wave energy, we're recognized as national leader in that new emerging technology. We were ranked number two in the nation among all the states in terms of energy efficiency investment this past year. So we're, and of course, our lead and green building reputation is worldwide now in terms of the folks that are working in that sector. But turning to the climate package that the governor's developed, some of the package will and the goals are to reduce global warming threat and achieve the greenhouse gas reduction goals that we have in statute, to promote clean energy to boost energy efficiency for homes and businesses, to provide transportation choices, and to position Oregon as a leader in the global transition to a clean energy economy while creating thousands of family-based jobs for Oregon, Oregon's workforce. And the package, again, which is the second piece that you were distributed, it can be broken down into four areas of focus. These all overlap, but we've kind of characterized them in these four areas for ease of kind of reference. The new greenhouse gas standards proposals and Senate Bill 101, Senate Bill 80, and House Bill 2186 are the primary vehicles for that. Senate Bill 101 would require that new electricity sources be at least as clean as natural gas plants. It's called often called an emissions performance standard. The legislature has considered this in previous sessions, and we're hoping that this is the session that that legislation will pass. It's being tailored and modeled largely after legislation that's already passed in prior sessions in Washington and California. Again, this would create a clear regional signal in terms of resource use going forward. Senate Bill 80 is the cap and trade bill. It directs the Environmental Quality Commission to develop a plan for participation in a regional cap and trade system and bring that plan back to the legislature in 2011 for review. House Bill 2186 authorizes the Environmental Quality Commission to develop other greenhouse gas regulations and standards, and specifically focuses highlights the low carbon fuel standard, as was noted previously, idling of trucks and vehicles, and other opportunities where we can reduce emissions. The second major area category is investment in clean energy, and
David, House Bill. Yep. We actually are running out of time, so I think what we're going to do is ask if there's any specific questions, because we're going to have time. We're going to have hearings on all these
sure.
bills.
Sure, yeah, and yeah,
if you could just wrap up.
Okay, so, yeah, I can take any questions on the list of bills. You see it's quite extensive, but it's not overwhelming. It was these bills were put together over a year and a half period. There were large stakeholder involvement. There was an energy efficiency work group that worked very hard in developing the concepts that came into this package. The renewable energy work group developed concepts that came into this package, and then also there's a transportation work group process that developed the climate related pieces of that legislation. So large stakeholder input that result in what you see before you today in the governor's agenda. And I will not, it talks a little bit briefly in terms of the Western Climate Initiative and how that interacts with the state and with what the legislature is considering around cap and trade, and just a little update in terms of where that is at. I won't read through that, but it's briefly in here. I'm happy to answer any questions as well.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Representative Boone and then Bailey.
Thank you, Dave. Do you have on 2180? Do you have an amount of that fund, and are they limited megawatt funds or projects or something like that? Is that what that is?
2180. And I'm going off of this sheet now. The chart here would do a few things. It would expand the business energy tax credit program for industrial scale efficiency. I'm not sure if that's where you're.
No, this says creates new renewable energy fund to support community renewable energy projects.
House Bill 2180.
Yeah, that's so that's it does several things. That fund is a new proposal for the Department of Energy, and it, as it says, is focused on stimulating some of the community renewable energy projects that are close, but oftentimes not either from a feasibility, just getting the financing due to the feasibility, and or putting together the capital to make them get over the hump. It would be an additional tool to try and make some of those projects go forward.
Just a quick follow-up.
Yeah, follow-up.
Amount of the fund. Is there an amount?
The mechanism is it would be based on contribution from taxpayers, and so I think we're projecting $1 million initially. Whether it materializes or not would largely depend on how many people actually contribute into the system.
Okay. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. Mr. Van Hoff, is it the opinion of your office and of the governor that there is a value in early action on climate change in getting out front of the curve, whether to Oregon's economy or whether to shaping larger processes? And have there been any specific studies that you know of that quantify some of that value? And I'd be curious if Ms. Malins has any comments on that as well.
Yeah. I mean, the governor's view is that there is great benefit in early action, both at two levels. One is what's proposed in terms of the WCI regional system and what the governor's proposal is around legislation for cap and trade. That system doesn't go into effect until 2012. And so what we think that by creating clear direction in terms of where we're heading, we can then utilize some of these other measures that are in the package in terms of what happens between now and 2012 to invest in it, really maximize and increase investment in energy efficiency and prepare our business sector and consumers for the transition to a regulated carbon economy, whether it be through the Western Climate Initiative or through federal legislation and programs or what have you. So it's getting us ahead of the curve rather than trying to catch up to the curve. And believe me, you know, the states that are participating in this have gotten both from at the governmental staff level, at the private sector level, much more engaged in the issues around both not just the mechanics of a cap and trade, but also carbon regulation and this emerging economy. So we believe it's positioned our state and our stakeholders in a much more competitive place than much of the rest of the nation. Other benefits that we've focused on has been trying to help shape the federal conversation prior to the Western Climate Initiative and kind of the Western perspective entering the conversation. Much of the federal discussion was driven by the East Coast states that had already begun a process around cap and trade. And, you know, with our resource base, our hydro systems, our forests, our ag sector, we wanted to make sure that we were trying to maximize and one look at carefully from our own perspective what should be part of a cap and trade program and then advocate for that to be part of any federal system that emerges. And the feedback that we've gotten from the federal folks that work in the federal arena is that the actions taken and the size and the scope and breadth of the Western Climate Program has really been taken note at the federal level and has accelerated the conversations that are occurring there. And as I think our industry stakeholders will say, and as I think you heard from all three of the states, having a national program is a goal of everyone's. It's an important place to be, but we think that we need to drive that conversation and move this our regional program forward in the meantime.
Anybody on the Senate side? Any questions?
I don't know.
Any other questions?
Let Ms. Malin address that question quickly. I know okay. Representative Bailey wanted to hear from her, and then Representative Smith, and I think that'll be it over here.
I'd just like to bear out some of the comments that David Vantoff has made, that the UK went ahead and implemented its own UK emissions trading scheme in advance of the EU emissions trading scheme with a similar rationale, and we have found, our experience has been that it's enabled us to be influential, you know, thought leaders in terms of how the bigger scheme developed. It's also equipped our businesses to be you know, better able to interact with the emissions trading scheme when it moved to an EU level, and to have made incentivized their early investment in low carbon technologies, which has, you know, kept them competitive with other business. It's also been significant in terms of engaging public opinion, and that has been really important in terms of, you know, our wider policy development.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Yeah, and good to see you, Dave Vantoff. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also thank you both chairs for putting this together. Thanks, everybody, for listening and sticking around, even though it's getting late. You know, it's late for us, but I know it's also late for you who don't even get to ask questions. So thanks very much. I have three questions, and because I have three, I can anticipate the answers waiting for written responses or hallway conversation after, which would be totally fine for me. But three questions for later conversation, perhaps. First, with relationship to our friends from the United Kingdom, their plan included robust public engagement. I'd be interested in conversation later, notes about what we can do, what we are doing in our state around public engagement. I've seen good stuff already, but interested in that first. Second, how can we... Representative Gilliam made a good point the other day, which is we segregate our conversations among various divergent committees, and we hear our bills as they come along. But every committee is operating within the context of a global financial crisis. And I think it's important, even at, you know, week three of a 5.5 month session, to see every challenge we have through the optic of that crisis. And so my second question is, how can we see this set of issues through that optic, and how might it interact, how might they interact, and how might it be, in fact, an opportunity for us, perhaps, potentially, to be the Silicon Valley for a new energy economy, for instance? That's my second question. My third and last question, how, also related to how we segregate ourselves in divergent rooms, and I know there's also a transportation package conversation. How does this overlap with a transportation package conversation? For instance, I think there's $15 million to build a $4 billion, you know, study a $4 billion non-shovel-ready bridge between Portland and Vancouver. You know, how are we interfacing the values we're talking about today with sort of the other conversation? So economy here and climate change there.
Yeah,
David, you've got 30 seconds.
I'll try and take them in order. On the first one, and it helps me to at least introduce a bit about the governor's proposal for Senate Bill 80, the cap and trade proposal. Really, that largely what that is designed to do is to try and take the next steps from a public outreach perspective. It would create a public process over the next year and a half to work through and get a lot of feedback, both build support and get feedback from stakeholders and the public, and not just the normal group of stakeholders that are in the room around these issues, but really citizens and others as well, to try and build that whole process. And we can talk about what has occurred from a stakeholder perspective in terms of the Western Climate Initiative and work to date. But that's a big focus in the proposal, which is go out and do a lot of that outreach, come back to the 2011 legislature with the benefit of that knowledge, which fits, I think, a bit into the second part of your question, which is, again, there is a lot of uncertainty in terms of the economy today and with the possibility of federal legislation. What the governor's proposal does, we believe, is provide that kind of transition so that while we would be taking affirmative steps this session, we would have the opportunity in 2011 to say, okay, where's the economy at now? And what is the cost-benefit analysis of the specific design proposals in this bill? How does that fit into where the economy is at in 2011? What has the federal government done in the meantime, and is this still a necessary step to take? All those pieces would be played out in that process. So I think it segues well into that. And then on the transportation, we can do a hallway conversation. I highlight the at least the climate-related portions of the bill. Certainly stakeholders are, and the governor is trying to message this as a comprehensive approach. So it's not pick, you know, I like this and that. We're trying to say this is a comprehensive strategy, and the transportation part of it is essential. Transportation is a huge part of our emissions. We haven't done in the past significant climate change policy work in the transportation arena, and we need to start doing that, and that's what the governor's proposal would do.
Thanks much. We'll talk more later. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for great questions. Okay, well, with that, we will adjourn the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources and close the informational meeting. I want to thank all the speakers again for coming today, and we will make sure and send the follow-up information to all the members.
And I will close the House Environment and Water Committee. Thank you.